From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I'm sitting across from a director who's had her second film play the Sundance Film Festival this year. Her first film was Obvious Child. The star, Jenny Slate, was here. Her second film was Landline. We have to talk about the title, whether it's the writer-director, Gillian Robespierre. First of all, thanks so much for being here, Gillian.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be talking to you.
Now, you'll be sleeping like a baby in no time. I'll fix that. Tell me about the title, because nothing suggests the 20th century more than a landline.
Right. Yeah, the landline was so important in my childhood. I grew up in the 90s in Manhattan, lower Manhattan, but the landline was the thing that connected our whole family, and it connected you to the outside world. It was, you know, pre-social media, pre-Wi-Fi, and if when you left school and came home, that was your only connection to the outside world. And if you wanted to make a plan with somebody and go to the movies, you would have to call them up, you know, meet them on the street, and if they weren't there, that was it, you know.
There's actually a shocking scene where the dad in the film, played by John Turturro, pulls his daughter's phone out of the wall. And had that been a 90s movie, you would have heard the audience gasp.
Yeah.
Now you kind of think, oh, yeah, people used to do that.
I know. What are timeouts now? I don't know.
You tell me. What do? Turn off the Wi-Fi,
yeah,
in the
house? Yeah, you disconnect the Wi-Fi, take the Apple TV out. Yeah, I think that's probably what we do. I'm not looking forward to that, but I have a long ways to go because my kid's only two.
But this again reminds me of this moment in the movie where that phone is pulled out of the wall. And talk about what gets us to that. First of all, let the audience know what the film is about before we go any further.
Yes. So the film is about two sisters, played by Jenny Slate and Abby Quinn, who discover that their father, who's played by John Turturro, is having an affair on their mother, Edie Falco.
And the question is it a physical affair or an emotional affair?
Right. And does it matter?
Yes.
I think the girls realize that it is a physical affair. There is some, you know, lower back touching, but the conclusion is it doesn't really matter. It's about families not really being honest with each other. And there's a disconnect in this household between every family member. And when you first meet them, they're all living their lives very individually and coming home, and they're stuck in these roles where these designated roles that they can't really wiggle out of, you know, the obedient daughter or the rebellious daughter, you know, the working mom who's supposed to have it all together, and the artist dad who's unsatisfied in his day job, and they're not being honest. And so we try to show a family that seems to be unraveling, but they actually come together for the very first time because they're forced to through the cheating, lying, and stealing.
But also, too, what's interesting about this, and there's a little bit of this in Obvious Child as well, is people who can't be what they want to be. So the three adults in the house, the oldest daughter, the mom, the dad, have one role, but they all want to be something else. And the youngest daughter doesn't know what she wants to be yet. So
this somehow is the wisest in many ways.
Yeah. I think because she is more eager to experience than anybody else, and is also the generational thing, too. She's not as judgmental about her experience as her mom, dad, and sister are.
Yeah, and I think Liz and I, my co-writer and producer Liz Holm and I, are not judgmental writers. I think we really try to lay out a family and humans and not really judge their actions and let them flail, let them make mistakes, let them be really vulnerable and sometimes unlikable in order to relate to them and to sort of want to root for them. And I think imperfection is quite beautiful, and I like showing that I'm not imperfect at all. I happen to be a perfect person, but I like showing imperfection, and I like watching imperfection, and I love people who don't necessarily seem who make mistakes, and but they're not vilified for them, you know. And I think in our culture, you know, a lot of times women, just look at our past election, are not allowed to lie, are not allowed to be strong and have a voice. They get, you know, penalized for that. And in our movies, we try not to do that to any of our characters, male or female. But, you know, this movie definitely is through the lens of three women in one family, multi-generation. It's the youngest daughter, who's a teen, and Jenny's character, who's in her early 20s, and, you know, the mother character, the matriarch of the house, who's really pretty much the glue of this family. And she seems really tough, and you don't know that she's holding in this secret.
Well, I guess it was allowing me to show my imperfections, and I think that's very big of her, as director Gillian Rose-Bier. Her new film as director is Landline, is The Treatment. We're talking about separate these people on. There's actually a scene just after the very opening of the movie where the entire family and prospective son-in-law are in the car, and the old Stevie Winwood song is playing Higher Love, and just about who these people are, the way they sing the song, or everybody's sort of singing a different version of the song. Literally, in the case of Dana's, in the case of Jenny Slate's character, she doesn't even get the words to the song because she's made it, and we can sort of see that she doesn't quite connect in some way. She's got her own narrative about what the world is rather than encountering it on its own terms.
Yeah, that's really observant and thoughtful. Thank you. I think that that's what happens in a car with a family. And, you know, I think it was such a great way to show everyone's personalities in a short period of time in the opening of the film, when you just sort of trap them in a small boxy Volvo, you know, windows up, no AC. And that exposes their personalities, their cracks, you know, in the relationships, and also what bonds them and their sort of openness. And, you know, what I love about that moment with Dana, Jenny's character, is that she does feel free enough and comfortable enough to sing at the top of her lungs in the back of a car with her family. And you know that this is a real family, but that they're all on different planes and thinking different things. And, you know, the dad is sort of absent-mindedly quiet, not really involved in the discussion. You know, Edie's character is on top of everything, especially her younger daughter, and wanting to, you know, fill out her college applications. I do remember those times vividly, and it was, you know, it's rough. It's a rough time in a family when you're changing. And that's another reason why we set it in the 90s. 90s New York was sort of going through this real physical change. Well, Giuliani was in office, and he was doing some strange things to the city and to the people within it, but it was really the last era that middle-class families could really exist in Manhattan. You know, I got booted out of Manhattan in early 2000. I could no longer afford it. Now I live in Brooklyn, and I really was sad to leave Manhattan, and now I can't afford Brooklyn. It's just, it's changing. But the 90s were, you know, taking on a new shape alongside with our families. When Liz and I, who, you know, we wrote this movie together, both of our parents got divorced when we were teenagers in the 90s. So it was kind of a poetic parallel between New York City and our families taking new shape. And also, it's fun not to have to write a scene where somebody goes on Facebook. I just don't want to see that anymore.
Yeah, or to look at it and go, wow, by the time the movie comes out, the cell phones they're using will be out of date already.
Yeah.
But what I like that scene, and also I like the way your characters exist in both of your films in relationship to popular culture. There are a lot of songs in this movie by women, actually,
mm-hmm.
and clearly they're used for dramatic points. I mean, there's a shift from Two of Hearts to Down by the Water. I mean, the soundtrack goes from P.J. Harvey to Candy State. I mean, that's a pretty long...
Norma Frazier, even Angel Olsen, who's contemporary.
But but that was clearly a big part of the way these characters define themselves. And the mom's talking about, well, disco, you know, you were conceived in Studio 54, you were there in utero, rather. And that idea of people, that also sort of tells us who everybody is, too. And going to get back to that first scene, the car for a second, Ralph, I think it's such a great telling scene. I wonder why you decide to sort of start the movie at that, because it's so powerful. It tells us who and what everybody is. It's sort of, in its way, a capsule version of the movie.
Yeah, you know, music is so important in our lives, and I think it's such a great way in movies, which is a visual medium, but to sort of expand on who these characters are. It's such a great symbolic way of, you know, explaining who somebody is. So we got to do Steve Winwood for the Dead and do Dad Rock and Disco for Edie and some nice B-side songs from the 90s. I mean, I don't think PJ Harvey's Down by the River is a B-side, but there was a Sebado song in there and Archers of Loaf. And then, you know, Dana is a little more square, and so she would probably listen to more top 40. But
you made that pretty clear about her. Again, her choices in popular culture.
Well, 10,000 Maniacs. Oh, God. I mean, I was such a fan of that. I was pretty square. But, yeah, that was, you know, what I was listening to in the 90s. And so it was a great way to sort of get everyone into the era, but also get into the minds of the characters.
Yeah, because it's so interesting that people almost identify by who and what they listen to or they do. And the dad, played by John Turturro, is this guy who fancies himself a poet. And there's a great moment where the younger daughter finds his, and if you pardon me for saying this, but this term comes up a lot these days, smoking gun, and prints it out. That's how far back this movie is. But just that poetry could have been written by a teenager, which is I think you can sort of see it knocks the breath out of her for that reason.
Yeah, it's hard to see that your parents are sexual and lust, you know, and it's rare that you see your parents even kiss each other when you're a kid. And, you know, the love is probably there, but it's gone a little stale. But yeah, this is to see your dad as like a horny, lusty guy and acting like a teenager and writing bad poetry is really alarming. Parents, I think when you're younger, you see them as these perfect beings. And that's not necessarily good to have.
But that's kind of key to this too, because it's the youngest daughter is somebody who hurts so much because she's got so much hope. I mean, because she is still have this kind of belief. And once you sort of get past the disappointments of the mom and the dad and the older sister, they still have hope too. I mean, that's what sort of keeps them going, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what we kind of ended the movie on, this note where the family's, you know, going to stay together. But I don't think John and Edie's characters are going to be married for very much longer. They're probably already divorced by the time we're in the last Benihana scene or the papers are being drafted. But that doesn't matter.
But that's implicit rather than explicit in the film.
Right, right. People might think that one look might be flirtatious or sad in a way that he's trying to get her back. But that's for the audience to sort of leave with their own feelings on that. I definitely feel like they don't stay together. And that was really more implied than the idea that they are together at the end of the movie. But they're coming together and they're going to be friends and they're going to be co-parents and they're going to make sure that they treat each other with respect and try to remember the love, because they have these two amazing daughters to raise and to be, you know, part of their lives. And they're going to not be selfish any longer.
Well, hold on, I thought we'd talk a little bit more about that. We're going to take a little break and talk more about the 90s and the new film Landline with this director, Gillian Rose Pierce. The treatment more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Who was a bad girl last night, but she still managed to show up here, and I can't thank her enough for that, is Gillian Rose Pierce. Her new film as director is Landline. It's The Treatment. You were talking about your young star, Abby Quinn, who does a great song, actually. I mean, there's a first verse of a song that basically is like a journal entry, and it's so funny.
Mr.
And so much
Rubicki. Yes, Abby and I wrote that together on set. We did lyrics together. I did not write the music. I am talentless than that area. But that was, yeah, it was fun. So we were casting. We were looking for somebody to play the role of Allie, the youngest sister. And we knew that she had to play against Jenny Slate Edie Falco, John Turturro, and this was a tough role. And we wanted somebody who still was a teenager, but not necessarily 16, but who could play that age and also still play this, you know, savvy New York City kid who thinks that she's smarter than everyone in the room. And sometimes she is and sometimes she isn't, but most of the time she is. And when we saw Abby's tape, we were blown away. And then we met her and she was just a sweet girl who is actually from Michigan.
But she really was from Michigan.
Yeah,
right?
And she's nothing like her character. I mean, she's strong like her character, but, you know, we had to teach her how to smoke, and I don't think she curses that much.
I'm from Michigan. I know that's the case. But yeah, because that conversation in the car is about Michigan at the very beginning of the movie.
Yeah, and sometimes it creeps in the way she says dad, you know, like.
We can hear the vowels.
Yeah,
yes.
And, you know, what a. But, luckily, this isn't 1995, so we did Google her when we were in the like casting process, and she has on YouTube like a clip of her at a talent show singing "Toxic" by Britney Spears, but acoustic, and it's so good. It's so good. So we rewrote a scene to make her, you know, showcase her amazing voice and talents. But it's nice to show a woman on screen, a young girl on screen, who just doesn't, you know, have sex and do. You know, drugs, or, you know, that she's, well, you know, three-dimensional, that every woman in this movie hopefully has three dimensions to them.
No, because she has a friend who does drugs. I don't want to give too much away, but
yeah.
She asks her friends questions that show her concern about her welfare without her, again, being judgmental about what her friend is doing.
Yeah, and she's dipping her toes into some serious waters, but I think she's not the type of person who's going to be too influenced by anybody. I think finally she opens up and can be influenced in a great way by her relationship with her older sister. And I think what happened when we were making Landline and we were sitting in the edit was that we saw this chemistry between Jenny and Abby that necessarily wasn't on the page.
There's one great scene that's indicative of that, about their physical relationship, when there's a shower scene. That's really funny and very sweet and kind of tender, but also shows that they know each other. And I just thought, so much of this movie is about intimacy between people and being demonstrated in ways that people aren't explaining it. And I think that's something you tend to do a lot. It happens a lot in Obvious Child, too.
Yeah.
We can sort of tell how close people are by the way they touch each other.
Grooming is such a big part of it, is intimacy. Grooming somebody else, you know, picking their wedgie, which is what this character is doing. But, you know, taking food out of their hair, it's very animalistic. But we are the animals, you know, so.
But that's a great thing to.
It's also sweet.
It is that, but it also, it's this thing that it tells
or
everything.
Finn's character picks lint off of Jenny's lapel, and it's just, that's flirtation, too. It's intimacy.
Also the way she absently sort of strokes his hand when they reconnect.
Yeah.
And. It's just, she's not doing it on purpose. You can just sort of see it's just, there's something about New York that I think really talented filmmakers and artists can capture, which New York, unlike Los Angeles or Michigan, is a place where you're always close to people just because of the size, especially Manhattan.
Yeah.
So the way you comport yourself with that proximity is really important. And that's something I've seen in both of your films. And I wonder if that's a conscious thing for you, that idea of touching and stroking and gesture and leaning in a little bit too close to talk that might.
It's partly conscious because it's written on the page that somebody touches the other person like that. But it's also shooting on location. You know, we're not shooting at Steiner Studios in a big soundstage. We are finding real locations that are New York City locations that are small. So it's also where you can place the camera and where you can place the actors. And so it's a little bit logistical that characters who are talking at a party in, you know, Manhattan are going to be sort of on top of each other. But also the grooming stuff was in the script, and it's definitely something that I do with people who I'm close with. You know, I think last night at our premiere, like, went up to Abby and, you know,
cleaned her face. And Jenny did that to me earlier during press day. I had like a big black streak of soot or something for all of the on-camera stuff that I didn't notice. And she walked up to me and she just rubbed it off. And I think, you know, that's affection and intimacy and real love.
It's the treatment. We're talking about intimacy with the director of the new film, Landline, Gillian Robespierre. I guess one of the things I want to mention, too, especially in this movie, is that there are a lot of parties in this movie. And each of these parties is sort of about the emotional state of the characters and also about the different worlds that each of these parties contain. And talk to me about writing those scenes, because, again, there's so much information. You're basically using film grammar to sort of to convey intimacy.
Yeah.
And proximity. I know maybe I'm harping on this a little bit, but
no, this
I just
is
think it's
cool. I'm having a good time talking about this.
But I think it's those, talk about staging those parties and why you did, because each of these characters, at some point we see them in a party, we see who and what they really are mm-hmm. in these party scenes.
Yeah. I guess a good example is the rave. So we see Abby Quinn's character, who's the teenager, sneak out of her apartment, very New York City style, where you hide clothes in the stairwell. I used to do that, but I was more responsible. I would write post-it notes on my pillow, and I would just say, I'm not kidnapped, I'm not dead, I'm not running away, I really love you, I love everything about being at home, because I was a homebody too, but I tried to like flex some rebellious muscles in high school, and I'll be home. I just went downtown, you know, to go to a rave. She never found the notes. She claims she's never even once seen any of my post-its. So that was good. But she did catch me a couple of times coming home at 4 a.m., and that terrified her. So Abby's at the rave and she's trying to, you know, she's walking that line between adulthood and childhood. It's that formative moment where you're just really needing to be independent. So she sneaks out and goes to a rave, and it's a school night and she has a paper due the next day, and she's going to do something that's very scary, and she does it for the very first time. But what she does do when she goes home is she puts, you know, her floppy disk in and she goes to write her paper. And I think that sort of bookends the gesture of and tells you who this character is, that she's going to try something crazy and very scary and dangerous, but she's also going to be okay, because at the end of the night, she's going to do her homework. She's going to write her paper, and she's able to balance that for such a little person, and somebody who's in that vulnerable, you know, stage in life. You kind of know that she's going to be okay if she's, you know, if she's going home to do schoolwork after being high on very powerful drugs. So that's a great way to understand a character and a person's motivations and who they are. And doing that without that much dialogue and doing it all visually, it's really, that's what's exciting about trying to tell stories, especially about a family, because you have so much to tell in such a short amount of time, and you have to find clever ways of shaping them and making the viewer know who they are, but without it being just like over-explaining, because audiences are really smart.
Yeah, like the kind of thing they might have seen in Curly Sue. Anyway, so
best movie ever, Curly Sue.
Best TV show ever. Apparently,
she's
mad
so
about
dirty.
You. Oh, but again, there's a party scene with the older sister. There's a party scene for each of these characters, and we get to see who they are in these.
Yeah,
scenes.
You're right. I never even.
Oh, is that not a conscious thing that you did?
Not the part. No. I mean, we get to. It's seeing them out in the world. You know, I think families usually just hang out in their apartments, but we wanted to definitely push them out of their safety zone and put them in the world. But no, I don't think Liz and I sat down and said, we are writing party scenes for each of these characters. We're just putting them out in the world and seeing how they exist.
Well, the other thing I guess I wanted to ask you about, too, is you have, is the parents, two actors who were working in New York in the 90s,
mm-hmm.
and talk about meeting Edie Falco and John Turturro and getting them on board.
And they've never been in a movie together. they both came up in the 90s in New York as actors, and I think they have friends in common. John's cousin is very good friends with Edie.
Who was in The Sopranos. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They might have had like a couple Thanksgivings together, but they have never been on screen, and especially not in a relationship. And it was a dream come true. It was so wonderful to be able to do that and to work with them, and I learned so much from each of them. It was quite easy. We sent them a script, and they loved it. I met with Edie near her apartment. We had coffee, and, you know, I think she just wanted to make sure I wasn't totally crazy. And I went to John's house, and we ended up talking about the script, but also about politics, and had tea. We were both sick. And again, I think they were just trying to make sure I wasn't completely insane or a child. So it was great. And it was very organic how it happened. And I remember seeing Edie in a Hal Hartley movie in the 90s called Trust at Angelica. And she just was somebody who stood out for me in that movie. And the way she would chew gum and smoke and how her voice was, I can't explain it. I just remembered her. And then I hadn't seen her in a long time, and maybe until The Sopranos.
Well, she's working a lot.
But she's working a ton in the 90s, and I was just, you know.
She was in Oz, for God's sake. She did.
Oh, my God, that's when, yeah, Oz.
She went from Oz to The Sopranos, but she was doing a bunch of little movies.
But Oz was terrifying.
Yes, it was. I just want to get back to this a little bit, because I was going to say, casting these two sort of basically downtown New York icons in a movie together, and having them do this for the first time, what was it like for you watching them shoot, do a scene together? What was the first scene they shot together? And what was your reaction to watching that as you were seeing it?
The first scene we shot in the whole movie was the scene when John comes home from work and he has the yum-yums in the kitchen.
The almost Oreos.
Yeah, the fake Oreos that'll give you cancer. And it was very surreal. And there's, I think, a photo of me in Video Village, which was a bathroom. Yeah, that's what shooting in New York is, sitting on a toilet with two monitors, you know, next to the DP and Liz in the bathtub. And it was, it's glamorous, but I'm smiling so hard and I'm glowing. And it's because watching the two of them in my little monitor was a dream come true. And I said that in a weird dream come true.
Did you say that to them? Did you say, this is a thrilling thing for me to cast you people who should have been together in a movie a long time ago?
I don't know if I used those words, but I definitely gushed and said thank you many, many days and made sure that everyone was happy and excited to come to work and felt that it was a real collaboration.
Well, it feels like that, and we're out of time. I can't thank you enough for doing this, especially at such short notice. Thank you so much, Gillian.
Thank you, and I'm not hungover from my premiere last night. I'm totally
notice she smelled like cigarettes. My guest is Gillian Robespierre. Her new film, which just played Sundance this year and is about to come out now, is a film, Landline. Again, thanks for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Our recording engineer, who also mixes the show, is Kat Yor. It's edited by Blake Vite, who's associate producer. I'm surrounded by women, so it's a good life. It's the treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.